This week's programme, a novel from the Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk that's set in 1980 on the eve of a military coup. We're in a fishing village near Istanbul. A 90-year-old widow and her manservant await a visit from her grandchildren. Each chapter is seen through the eyes of one of the story's characters, beginning with the manservant, who's a 55-year-old dwarf and illegitimate child of the widow's husband. From the outset, it's clear that this manservant has a difficult boss. He's just brought her dinner. "Well, this is a new one," she said. "Why do you go inside when I'm eating?" I didn't answer. "They're coming tomorrow, aren't they?" she said. "They're coming, madam. They're coming," I said. That's part of the opening scene of The Silent House by Orhan Pamuk. With me, Adrian Kenny, a novelist who lived for some years in Turkey, the poet Michael O'Loughlin, and our regular fiction reviewer, Julia Carlson. Michael, what did you make of this?
The strange thing is, I'm a big fan of Pamuk, and I started reading My Name is Red and The Black Book. But it's very strange, because this is an early novel, which has only been recently translated.
1983, if I remember.
It's published in 1983. It's not his first novel, but it's his second novel. And it's very interesting, because you're reading it through the prism of the later novels. And I enjoyed it, but I wondered, would it have been translated if he hadn't written the later novels, because it's very much a young man's novel. But you can see all the themes and the obsessions that surface in the later books. So it's interesting on that level.
And Julia, what did you think of it? Because I know you reviewed the Museum of Innocence, didn't you?
The
early book. Yes.
I did.
So
yes.
What did you make of this?
Yeah, I like this very much. I thought it was very readable and a very interesting novel in terms of the way in which at first you think that it's actually quite a simple little book as you read it. But then suddenly as you go back through it again, you realise that it's very layered and that there's actually kind of in terms of subject matter an enormous amount going on in it.
And for you, Adrian, what was your reaction?
I liked it. We were here last year talking about the Museum of Innocence. And you see, it's first novels, or as Michael points out, second novels even. The themes of a writer are more obvious in the beginning. Maybe you're more open or innocent. You see all the obsession with the East-West divide. It's set again on the Bosphorus. The action goes back and forth between East and West. It's a great myth, the East standing for indolence, Islam, ignorance, the West standing for civilization, rationalism, and in the end, nada. And the novel bats back and forth between these two shores and these two views of life. So, yeah, I think it's a wonderful theme. I mean, it's a myth, but it's a wonderful myth.
Does the 90-year-old widow, Fatma, does she blow the other characters out of the water or not, Michael?
He tells the story with different characters. Each chapter is a different character, and they. I would have liked to have heard more. I thought she was slightly underwritten, the grandmother, Fatma, who's this 90-year-old, almost bedridden woman. And as I was reading her, I kept wanting to know more about her childhood, and I wanted to know more about her inner life. And I felt that he became more interested in the younger characters. The problem is,
but she's a powerful presence.
She's this brooding presence upstairs with a cane rattling on the ceiling. But we find out later on in the novel that she's actually not a very benign character, and her husband has two illegitimate children with a servant, and it's all very symbolic because he's a Western secular fanatic. And one of the children is a cripple and the other is a dwarf. So it's all very laden with metaphorical significance. But it turns out later on in the novel, if I'm not giving away too much, that she is responsible for the deformation of the children.
Julia, does she blow the other characters out of the water? I mean, is she that strong or not?
Well, I think that what Michael says is interesting, actually, because in a sense we don't get as much of her, perhaps, as we could. There are glimpses into her childhood, which it would have been very interesting to expand. And in fact, a great deal of her thoughts have to do with defining her husband for us. So she's in, and this is one thing which is quite interesting about the novel, she's in almost a kind of constant dialogue with her dead husband. And this is a kind of technique in terms of narration.
Forgive me, that's the only view we have of him, isn't it? Through is through
no.
our eyes.
No, no, the no, no, because we also get him through the dwarf.
Oh, Risa, yes, of course. Of
who
course,
is
you're
his
right.
son.
You're absolutely
yes.
right. What did yeah. you make of Adrian? Again, I'm asking just to stay with that question.
Of Fatma.
Of Fatma, yes.
She's like an old Molly Bloom. I mean, I got a bit weary of the endless monologues going on and on in a stream of consciousness. She's like the original Irish Catholic Jewish, you know, traditional mother. She's snobbish. She believes her husband is going to hell because he didn't believe in Allah. She's a very typical Muslim.
That's set up in a straightforward binary way, isn't it? She the pro-religion person, and he, in your terms, Michael, a secular fanatic, is how you described him, or a fanatical secularist.
Well, he's kind of a product of modern Turkey, and he's trying to drag Turkey screaming into the 20th century in a kind of an Ataturk kind of project. And he's writing this huge encyclopedia of Western thought, which he hopes will influence Turkish society. But of course, like Casaubon in Middlemarch, he never actually finishes it. Unfortunately, as you said, we kind of only see him through the through Fatma's eyes, and a little bit through Recep occasionally. And he's, even though he's the main character almost in the book, because everybody is related to him, but he's a sort of a tragic character in the sense that his mission to modernize Turkey is doomed to failure.
And sees Turkish development very much in terms of catching up with a science-led Europe. You must have got a strong sense of that, Adrian, when you were there, of looking to Europe in that way.
It's probably a bit, this was written in 1983. I'd imagine now, especially with the crash in Europe, that Turkey is probably doing quite well.
Yes.
It's interesting, Michael was saying it's a layered novel, and Pamuk couldn't have foretold that Recep, the poor servant boy, is now the first name of the Prime Minister of Turkey, Recep Erdogan. This is set again in 1980. It's just the year after the Shah has been kicked out of Iran. America is looking for a new base in the Middle East, and they've decided it's going to be Turkey. And they're really engineering this coup by the army, which is going to put an end to the left-right fascist nationalist war and establish America position in Turkey, and Turkey is struggling. So again, this is another, it's an ideas novel, and I don't really think ideas novels work as novels.
Oh, that's a very strong
statement. Yeah, I know.
Deliberately. I mean, it was the last novel was very much an ideas novel.
I'll take that on.
Yeah. Do.
I think it's a novel which has very strong characters in it, and that you could read it as a very character-driven novel, and you could see the ideas as very embedded in each of the individual characters in a very convincing kind of way.
Adrian, you've chosen an excerpt. Perhaps you'd set it up for us.
It's the first evening of the action when Recep has fed his mistress, Fatma, Madame Fatma, and he walks down to see his brother, Ismail, in the village on the Sea of Marmara, and we see what his little world is like.
The wind blew cool from the sea, and it was pleasant. The leaves of the fig tree were rustling. I shut the garden gate and walked down toward the beach. Where our garden wall ended, the pavement and the new concrete houses began. They were on their balconies in their little narrow gardens, watching. Families listening to the news on TV, the women at their charcoal grills. They didn't see me. Meat on the grills and smoke. Families, lives. I wonder what it's like. When winter comes, though, there'll be nobody around. Then I'll be frightened just to hear my own footsteps in the empty streets. I felt myself shivering and put on my jacket and turned the corner. It was funny to think how they all sat down to eat their dinner and watch TV at the same time. As I was walking around in the back streets, a car pulled up at the end of one of those that opened onto the square, and a tired husband from Istanbul got out. He went into the house with his bag, looking upset to be getting home so late for his dinner in front of the television. When I got down to the shore again, I heard Ismail's voice. National Lottery, 6 days left.
Jerry McArdle, reading from The Silent House by Orhan Pamuk. I noticed you described the 90-year-old lady as his mistress, which might be pushing it a bit in your introduction in the old sense. Yes. But what do those images conjure up for you when you?
Well, it made me slightly nostalgic for Istanbul, and especially the outskirts of Istanbul, where you have quite a lot of these small villages and holiday resorts, where a lot of people live and they commute into work, and they're kind of interesting places. And a theme in the novel is real estate. In fact, it's one of the underlying sort of engines of the whole
novel.
Can't
get away from it.
No, because the novel is called The Silent House, and the Silent House of the title is the big house. Which was the original house and the first house in the fishing resort, apart from the fishermen's huts. And one of the characters in the novel spends the whole time trying to persuade Fatma, the grandmother, to sell the house so it can be developed into an apartment block. And he doesn't get his way, of course. But it is, you can see the development that Turkey underwent very quickly in the 70s and 80s in all these new apartment blocks which are scattered along the coast. And the Ishmael, the other son, made a massive mistake because the father gave him money to buy a house, and he bought a house up on the hill and not on the shore. And that's the tragedy of his life, that his house is worth nothing. If he'd bought it on the shore, he wouldn't have to be a lottery seller.
Anyway, the grandchildren arrive at the grandmother's house. Mm. There's Farouk, who's a heavy drinking historian. There's his brother, Metin, a student who longs to go to America, and Nilgun, their sister, who has left-wing political leanings. What of those characters, which of them caught your imagination most?
Well, I think they capture your interest in different kinds of ways. I mean, they are done in quite a schematic kind of way. And Farouk is the historian. He's talking about inheritance. But one of the interesting things that he's concerned with, I think, is the whole idea of storytelling. And this is a novel which is very much about the subject of storytelling and how history is told. History is a story, as he puts it. He's trying to look for the kind of thread. He's trying to look for causality.
Did you follow fully what he was on about there? It's kind of...
No, I found it very hard to follow Pamuk's argument, rather.
Pamuk's argument. I mean, for example, my own reading of it was that I mean, this is where, as you were saying, he's unburdening himself about his trade. That's the passage you're talking about, where he's, you know, talking about the thing itself. And his main concern seems to be that he wants to express life as it is, and that as if you could do that without a narrative, without a story, without a pattern of any kind, and he realises that you can't.
Yeah, well, I think that's for me, that was one of the most interesting parts of the novel, because Farouk is... He's the Pamuk character, because we're reading retrospectively. We've read the other novels, the historical novels, like My Name Is Red, and Farouk is trying to figure out. He's Pamuk trying to figure out how to write these novels. He's trying to come up with a philosophy of history, and there is a great passage where he's talking about, I'd love to publish a book that would be 6,000 pages long, unmediated, just the stories from the archives, but. As Julia said, people would say, well, where's the story? And you can see Pamuk, he's arguing with himself. He wants to write about Turkish history in the next novel, perhaps. And how is he going to do it? And, of course, we know while we're reading this novel that he did it by putting a story on it. So,
yeah, I mean, it's a clouded passage, though, perhaps it reflects the confusion in Pamuk's own mind. Do you accept, by the way, Julia, that's his alter ego? The historian is Pamuk's alter ego.
Yes, to some extent, certainly, that he is trying to work out ideas about storytelling and history in relation to that, very definitely. Yeah. But all of these characters are in a state of very definite confusion. All the way through.
Yeah.
I mean, you said who's most interesting. Metin is another character who's equally confused. And he's a teenager, just ready to go into his final year.
He's the one who longs to go to America.
He's the one who dreams of going to America.
How characteristic, how typical was that, Adrian, from your time there and your sense of it, that looking to America as the land of great hope?
Well, I suppose I could find queues around the corner outside the American embassy every day, but that's pretty well, I think, universal, isn't it?
Yeah.
About Farouk and the... Is it fair to say also that Farouk, he spends his days in the archives going through Ottoman papers back as far as the 15th century. I thought, maybe wrongly, that he's trying to find some way of drawing a lesson from all this that can bring Turkey into the modern Western world. In other words, that he won't just abandon it. What does it all mean now? Mm. And after one of his episodes, he ends up wandering in the field where Mehmet Fatih, the conqueror of Constantinople, died, and he finds an American chicky chick takeaway shop. And there's a feeling of absolute uselessness of his past. So I felt in one...
Searching for a use of some kind. You know?
Trying to find a tradition in a rather the way, because I come back to this, I know, maybe too much, the idea that Turkey and Ireland have the exact same birthday. They have the same sort of big man, De Valera and Ataturk. They have the same wondering about their traditions and what use they are.
I thought for a while that he was flirting with archival fundamentalism, you know, where he's trying to say he wants to write a book teeming with unconnected minutiae, as if there's no link, there's no story, there's nothing imposed by the writer, and realises you can't do that. But you can see that kind of hankering after just the archive there, untouched, unvarnished, unlinked.
Yeah.
There's that yearning, Michael, yes.
Yeah, I think that the Turkish attitude to history is very interesting. I disagree a little bit with Adrian. I think it's not quite the same as the Irish attitude, mainly because in Turkey there's just so much history. You're walking down a street in Istanbul and you'll find, you know, Greek columns thrown to one side as they drilled a hole to make a doorway. And there's a kind of an indifference almost to history.
Yeah.
Which I find absolutely fascinating. It's because I think the Istanbul attitude very much is, you know, people come, people go. You know, the Muslims come, the Muslims go. The Christians come, the Christians go. And the city stays the same without trying to impose a specific identity on itself, which is why Ankara is the capital and not Istanbul. Istanbul is kind of like the Dublin almost, or the New York. It's a mixture of different cultures. And I think that Pamuk is very, very aware of that. He's very much an Istanbul writer rather than a Turkish writer almost. Mm. And he's trying to be non-judgmental about history, I think. The interesting thing about Islam is that he doesn't actually talk very much about it in this novel, because in this novel, the political conflict is between the fascists and the communists, which makes it a little bit dated almost.
Can I just want just to stay on that? It seems to me a very revealing line is where he says, we'd have to alter the nature of our brains to see life as it is. And that indicates that hankering to get past mediating activities of any kind, to see things in the raw. Julia, you have a passage you'd like us to hear. Perhaps you'd set it up for us.
This is a passage where Hassan is thinking. He's a character who's kind of a loose cannon. He's become involved with a political group. And it's a passage about his fear. And I would say that fear is an emotion which for many of the characters dominates the novel. And here in this, it's a very short passage, but it takes on a lot of subjects and a lot of dimensions, because we get his fear of women, we get his fear of being a slave, a kind of cultural fear. There's the fear of sin, so there's the whole religious subject. And then finally, he kind of decides to give everything up, and there's a kind of what we've been calling, or what Selahattin calls, a kind of Oriental fatalism.
Women scare me sometimes. They're like things you just can't understand, with dark thoughts you can never know. Some parts of them are so horrifying, and disaster is waiting for you if you fall for them. They're a little like death that way, except dressed like a prostitute that stands there smiling at you with a blue ribbon in her hair. The sky turned yellow in the distance, and I started to worry about lightning. Clouds, dark storms, shadows I don't understand. Sometimes it's as if we're all slaves of someone we don't even know. Sometimes we stand there trying to fight back, but then there's fear of thunderbolts, lightning, of unknown distant disasters that will come upon us. At those moments I tell myself it's enough just to live in the peaceful light of our house without fighting back or knowing anything. I'm so terrified of sin, like my poor father, the lottery seller.
An excerpt from The Silent House, read by Jerry McArdle. What's going on there, I believe?
Well, the Hassan character is the young fascist, and he was the character, I suppose, I felt that Pamuk didn't empathise enough with him. I felt that he kind of gets a raw deal in the book. In the end, he does something terrible, but you feel it coming all along. And of course, the irony is that he's a cousin of the family because his father was the illegitimate son of Fatma's husband. So he represents, I suppose, the unreconciled Turk, the young Turk, who is disadvantaged, feels has a kind of a cultural inferiority complex, and is going to be a fascist, and in the end commits a terrible deed.
But do you think Pamuk might be more sympathetic towards him?
I think he could have been a little bit more
understanding of
what he does.
What did you make of Adrian?
Of Hassan?
Yeah.
I thought he was... The class thing is very strong, isn't it? He's ashamed that his mother wears a headscarf. Mm. You know, his father sells lottery tickets. He despises him. He has no hopes, really. So he's the sort of person exactly that would have joined a fascist party in whatever country last...
I found there was a certain kind of balance there. And certainly that his insecurities were very often on display, which gave him a kind of potential complexity, let's say, as a character. But actually, I found there isn't that much difference in many respects between him and the character Metin, who's the teenager
who wants to go to America,
who's equally insecure, who's equally obsessed with class, who feels equally deprived from having the class position that he would like to have. And both of them are on this kind of roller coaster, which leads in both cases to a very definite kind of violent behaviour.
There's a marvellous line from Metin. He says, "When I get to America, the first thing I'll do is make some very simple discovery in physics and immediately publish it in the journal that first published Einstein." It's a lovely line.
It's a great quotation. And one thing that's very interesting is that all of the male characters in the novel are writing these kind of stories for themselves about the kind of heroic people they're going to become. So he's going to go to America and he's going to become a kind of celebrity figure. Hassan is going to take trips. He's going to be involved in bloody wars. He's going to own a factory. He's going to become a commander. Selatan is going to be the new god of all the Muslims. Every single one of these characters has this kind of fantasy.
Fatma, the grandmother, wonders whether Recep, her dwarf manservant, is telling her grandchildren that she came to Recep and his brother with cane in hand. And I noticed that we're made aware of the presence of that cane in the third sentence of the novel. It's the kind of half
the big stick
all the time.
Fatma carries a big stick.
Yes. But you said something, Adrian, that you felt you found her wanderings slightly tedious.
Yeah, I think her monologues are too long. But nonetheless, we learn that she burnt all Dr. Selatan's papers, his life's work. She can't stand what she calls Christian writing. That's the Roman alphabet. All that damn writing that Ataturk introduced. I'm interested. I think in Dr. Selatan realizes he makes the great discovery, which is something universal in our time, I think, that when you wash away the whole Christian or Muslim or feudal or traditional society, which covered Europe for 1,000 years until the Second World War practically, what's left? And he realizes that when you take away belief in God, in class structures, in the land, feudalism, there's nothing. And he makes this great discovery. If you can just look at this wonderful nothingness, we'll get a new life. And it's literally nothing. And it's both a condemnation of the whole Western experience and an idea of a new beginning. I thought that was...
Why didn't she raid him? Was this simply that... I mean, she didn't...
It seems to have been an arranged marriage to begin with, and it seems to have been quite an unsatisfactory marriage from everybody's point of view. And she grew up. It's interesting having read Istanbul, which is the memoir, Pamuk's memoir, yeah, of his family, mm-hmm, and the class and the street and the apartment building he grew up in. And he came from that kind of family, people who were very important in the administration and in industry in the 19th century. And she comes from that very, very privileged background. But of course, in the new Turkey, people like her have been overtaken by the nouveau riche. And she feels she's constantly nostalgic for that. And her husband, the world that he's offering of Western education is even less attractive to her. So she actually hates her husband. And she hates everybody, frankly.
Yeah. But also, she doesn't consider him very effective. You get that impression, do you? You know, he doesn't get things done.
Well, he certainly isn't successful in the way that she would have hoped that he would have been successful. He arrived in the town to become a doctor. His practice failed. He became obsessed. And one of the things that's interesting here, I suppose, and it certainly surfaces in the later novels, is the kind of obsession that he has and her intolerance of this obsession.
Yeah. Are you all glad that this early novel was published for above 30 years standing? What's what you're feeling about it?
Okay, you put me on the spot there. I'm slightly ambivalent in the sense that I don't think it's a great novel, but it's a good novel. Would I have read it if I hadn't read the later books? Probably not, because I think it is slightly derivative. It's very American. He's read Faulkner and he's read The Great Gatsby, and there are scenes that are lifted almost straight out of those and put into a Turkish context.
Adrian?
Yeah, I'm glad I read it. As I say, to me, it's an ideas novel, and I don't think they're the first class, but they're always interesting.
And
yeah.
Julia?
Yes, I'm very glad I read it.
We've been discussing Silent House by Orhan Pamuk, published by Faber. My thanks to Julia Carlson, Michael O'Loughlin and Adrian Kenny. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.